The war in Afghanistan is now in its 12th year. What will happen when international forces finally leave? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we get a comprehensive view of the situation on the ground in Afghanistan from my guest, veteran journalist Peter Eichstadt. Eichstadt is visiting Iowa to speak before the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. His new book is titled Above the Din of War. Afghans speak about their lives, their country, and their future, and why Americans should listen. For the book, Eichstadt crisscrossed the country to interview an array of Afghans, former warlords, would-be suicide bombers, and frightened mullahs. The view from Afghans on the war and on U.S. involvement after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In a war now in its 12th year, the Obama administration is pressing ahead with plans to hand off security responsibility to Afghan forces and end NATO's combat mission by the end of next year. Over 60,000 U.S. troops are still in that country, about 100,000 troops altogether, including the international forces. What will happen when the international forces finally vacate Afghanistan? Well, that's a question many people are asking as the U.S. continues to draw down its troops. It's also a question at the heart of Peter Eichstadt's new book, Above the Din of War. Afghans speak about their lives, their country, and their future, and why America should listen. After spending 2004 in Afghanistan working for the nonprofit Institute for War and Peace Reporting and helping build Afghanistan's first independent news agency, Eichstadt returned to Kabul in 2010. He worked with Afghan journalists to document their history and collective struggles. He then crisscrossed the country to interview an array of Afghans. His experiences and conversations are the focus of his new book, Above the Din of War. Welcome to our program, Peter Eichstadt. Welcome back, I should say. We talked several years ago about Africa when you did your reporting there in Uganda.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. I was there right after a book came out that I had written about Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army. Mm-hmm. And ironically, Joseph Kony is still out there. He's moved from northern Uganda, and he's now rampaging around the Central African Republic.
We want to mention that next week you will be in Iowa speaking before the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council at noon on Tuesday, April 9th. The focus of your talk, I believe, Afghanistan in that case.
Yes, indeed.
Peter, I want to ask you to please start by talking about your personal experiences with Afghans, and then later on ask you to look at the bigger picture and perhaps draw some conclusions. But as your book indicates, we want to see if we can learn from what you've learned from talking to everyday Afghans and Afghans from a variety of areas. Can we start with something we don't hear much about here in the United States in the reporting about Afghanistan, Afghan journalism? Tell us what it was like, the challenges you faced in building Afghanistan's first independent news agency.
Well, that was actually one of the most exciting parts of my work there, is working with the Afghan journalists. And as you can imagine, they face the kind of challenges day-to-day reporting the news that most reporters in the West can only imagine. It's not unusual for them to be threatened, beaten, roughed up and pushed around. It's a great game of intimidation there by Afghan, politicians and political powers. For example, the real power structure behind the scenes in Afghanistan it still belongs to the warlords, and these are the same warlords that U.S. Special Forces allied with when in 2001 when we invaded and quickly helped topple the Taliban regime. But these warlords are still in key positions in government and in the parliament, and a lot of them have created their own media outlets. So they don't take very well to criticism or exposure of corruption and things like that.
Is it the case that every warlord has its PR department, so to speak, putting out the line that it wants to see?
Oh, absolutely. Some of them have even gone to the point of establishing their own TV and radio stations.
Really?
That promote their particular points of view.
Mm-hmm. What kind of tradition is there of journalism in Afghanistan? Do they have in their new constitution anything like a free press here in the U.S.?
No, not really. That's kind of a phenomena that's developed with the right after 2001. In fact, it's one of the free and vibrant independent news media and press is one of the real success stories in Afghanistan. But again, like you alluded to earlier, what's going to happen to that once the international community pulls out, after 2014 is a real question, because most of this independent, strong independent media there is supported one way or another by Western money.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often it's, for example, Western European and American companies or countries will provide public service announcements and that kind of thing to inform the Afghan public about the programs and opportunities they have available, for benefits and aids and development programs. And once these programs scale back, there's not going to be that source of income for these media.
I wonder how the journalists then who are financed this way are viewed by the society, the public at large. It seems they could easily be viewed as agents of Western powers and not something from within their own society.
Well, that's one of the concerns that the journalists I worked with, which were a broad spectrum of journalists across the country, they're very concerned because they have been trained by, our organization and other organizations in Western-style media, which is, trying to present a balanced picture of what's going on, talk to various sides of a conflict or an issue. And that's not a particularly strong tradition in Afghanistan. And a lot of them are very, very concerned about what happens when and if the Taliban comes back, because there was no room for dissent and no room for anything that's perceived to be anti-Islam, and that's how that what and what is not anti-Islam is broadly interpreted by whoever happens to be doing the interpreting at the time, and so anyway, they feel very, very threatened.
Have they in the recent years have journalists, Afghan journalists, been killed regularly?
Well, they've been, ironically, we've had a couple of incidents there where Afghan journalists were caught in the middle of some attacks. And one case in particular, I was involved with an Afghan journalist who was an independent guy, was killed by U.S. Special Forces. And this was, unfortunately, this man was in a government office building when it came under attack by Taliban. And as international forces charged into the building to retake it, they mistakenly assumed this guy was a member of the Taliban and was killed. So these are the kind of things that happen. In addition, Afghans are quite typically, Afghan journalists are receive threats from the Taliban, and they have to, and they're warned well in advance to quit working and talking with Americans. Some of the guys I worked with in the Helmand province in the south, in the capital of Lashkargah, one of these guys who's my driver and translator, he showed me on his phone the threats he was getting from the Taliban to stop doing what he was doing and working with me. So this is the kind of thing, I asked him, well, what are you going to do? And he just kind of shrugged and said, well, he just has to be careful.
Hmm.
But this is the kind of thing they deal with day in and day out.
My guest, if you just joined us, is veteran journalist Peter Eichstadt. His new book is titled Above the Din of War, Afghans Speak About Their Lives, Their Country, and their future and why America should listen. After working with Afghan journalists, you felt the need to get out into the country and interview all kinds of Afghans, former warlords, I understand a Taliban judge, poppy growers, women parliamentarians, mullahs, archaeologists. Let's talk about them a little bit. But first of all, why did you go out to survey other points of view and have conversations?
Well, I felt the biggest untold story in Afghanistan is the story about the people of Afghanistan. If you follow the news at all, you never hear anything about what average Afghans think about what's going on, what they think about the war, what they think about the government, what they think about their future. And to me, it was a huge void that needed to be filled, because you can't have a successful redevelopment or a successful military effort in a foreign country unless you have broad-based support of the people. And unfortunately, there's all of the goodwill that existed when we first went into Afghanistan in late 2001 and early 2002, all of that goodwill and happiness of being relieved of the Taliban regime is completely gone.
And it doesn't matter who you talk to, across the board, gone, even when you talk to women who have had an improvement in their situations, haven't they?
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, to me, it was, personally, it was frustrating, because I felt like, people like myself and the international community was doing a lot of good work, and the military was doing a lot of good work. But the frustrating part is that the day-to-day life in Afghanistan has really not improved, despite, we're now in our 12th year of war there. And the security situation is probably worse than ever, the reality of it, despite what diplomats and, in particular, U.S. military generals say. They like to use this broad brush term of, we're making progress. And to me, that's extremely frustrating, because we've been there a dozen years and we're beginning to make progress.
Yeah.
That, to me, is just absurd.
The longest war in U.S. history, longer than Vietnam.
Absolutely. What have we been doing all this time? What have we really accomplished? And what's happened is, because we've allowed the Taliban to come back, it's not just we, but because the Taliban has come back for various reasons, average Afghans are very, very frustrated, and they ask the question, which is, why hasn't the Taliban been able to be defeated? Why aren't our lives any better than they were when you guys came? And
that's
because the answers, are that things really haven't improved. That's why there's a growing sympathy for the Taliban.
Right, and it's interesting that you bring out in your book a perspective that I don't think we get in here in the United States, that on that point, Afghans believe that the U.S. could have defeated the Taliban at any time but didn't want to. Why would they think that?
Well, that's that's a very puzzling question, and I ran into that attitude very, very often. And I ask a number of Afghans that, and quite often I would just get a blank look. Some would say, well, they're interested in prolonging the war because they want to get their hands on Afghanistan's natural resources. And, but the fact of the matter is that the United States is not doing much to go after these resources. Ironically, countries like China and India are claiming and jumping on, mineral development leases and things like that. Another reason was that they suspected there was some overarching strategic reason, since the United States obviously has a difficult relationship, adversarial relationship with Iran at the moment, and where Afghanistan is literally in China's backyard. So they felt like maybe there's some overarching strategic reason. But I had phone conversations on three different occasions with Taliban leaders, and it was interesting, and I provided a list of questions, and then I had the Afghans, journalists I was working with actually ask the questions. We recorded them, and then I used the answers in my interviews, and they're very, very dedicated and committed. They're fundamentalist, very, very strong fundamentalists, and they're very committed to driving the Westerners out. And they are very, very effective in using this frustration that permeates the Afghan people, their frustration that things haven't improved. And they're saying, well, they use this as a public relations point, saying, well, that's because, you know, these people are really not here to help you. So why don't you join us and help drive them out of our country, and we'll turn this place around.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the Taliban is of Afghanistan. They are all also Afghans. But Al Qaeda, the reason we went into Afghanistan, and the Taliban was harboring Al Qaeda. Any of their presence there?
Well, I didn't encounter any. But what's happened is that the anti-government and the anti-Western sentiment has a kind of a fractured, and there's multiple different groups working. The Taliban is largely working in the south and the west, and then across the north there's various organizations, like this Hekmatyar is one of the key people in the north, and they have bases and camps just across the Afghan border and and it was called the Northwest Provinces of Pakistan, and they use those as bases to conduct attacks and quite often suicide attacks. And they, you know, they've been most security people now don't necessarily just talk about the Taliban. They talked about armed opposition groups. And so there's multiple fronts here that we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. And some of those are former warlord groups or present warlord groups.
Exactly. A lot of them that are former warlords that were aligned with the Taliban at one point. And so there, you know, there's a lot of different fronts, and it doesn't have just one face, the opposition. And another one of the frustrating factors that's working against the West is that the Karzai regime has been so scandalized with corruption that very few Afghans really identify with their own government. They see Karzai as a puppet of the West, and because of that, they don't share any real responsibility or have any identity with the Karzai government.
Corruption is a point that we do hear a lot about in our media here in the United States. I wonder if you could discover whether the corruption was made worse by the international forces entering 12-odd years ago, or if that's always been a part of Afghan culture.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that the Taliban came into power in 1996 was because of the chaos that had been created in the Afghan Civil War, which raged from about 1991 to 1996. And it's one of the virtues that, or at least that are professed or claimed by the Taliban, is that they eradicate all forms of corruption. Well, when the West came back, we put Hamid Karzai in power. He put in a lot of his family and friends in power, and they created the Kabul Bank, which has been the focus of millions of dollars of fraud, billions. And these are the kind of things that just really, really irritate the average Afghans, is that there's one story after another, corruption, and Karzai's inner circle and his cabinet have their fingers in all these lucrative contracts and businesses that get funneled to a very small group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And they see this plundering of Western aid, and very little of this aid actually reaches the ground that benefits the people who are intended to be the recipients of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the big frustrating factors that's contributing to the problems there.
Let's talk about what we hope is a fledgling democracy, but I'm not so sure after the few minutes of conversation with you. You describe in your book how you met with the president of Afghanistan's upper house of parliament. Describe that experience a little bit.
Well, what I tried to do as much as possible is to contact, in addition to average Afghans in all different corners of the country, I tried to contact some people who were the kind of the powers behind the scene. You know, in every society we have kind of low profile power brokers, and this man was his last name was Mujahideen, was really one of the long, he's in his 80s, and he's one of the long-term, you know, power brokers in the country. And when I was able to arrange a meeting with him, he was literally holding court in the upper floor of this large government building, covered with carpets and big drapes. And there were about 20 other Afghan elders sitting around with him. And I walk, you know, in this long hall and sit down at the end where he's in a large padded chair, wearing these immaculate white robes and a large white turban, and a very dramatic looking man. And we sat down and he spoke to me in flawless English, and was very, very adamant that that the United States really had taken what he considered a very schizophrenic approach to dealing with Afghanistan, and that he said the real problem with Afghanistan originates in Pakistan, and until the United States takes a firm hand and can either convince or force Pakistan to stop supporting the Taliban, there's going to be no peace in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And the quote he gave me, which sticks in my mind, is he said, America doesn't know who its friends are and who its enemies are. And that was a direct reference to Pakistan. And he said, how can you be giving millions, if not billions of dollars of aid to Pakistan when they turn around and spend it on the Taliban, which is the people that we're fighting? And he just would shake his head.
Journalist Peter Eichstadt is my guest. After spending 2004 in Afghanistan working for the nonprofit Institute for War and Peace Reporting and helping to build Afghanistan's first independent news agency, he returned to Kabul and greater Afghanistan in 2010. And his experiences in interviewing, talking with everyday average Afghans, but also interesting perspectives from poppy growers, would-be suicide bombers, archaeologists, mullahs. We haven't talked about a lot of things. Peter Eichstadt, I hope you'll stay with us for the second half of our show. We have to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment with Peter Eichstadt, Above the Din of War, his latest book, Afghans Speak About Their Lives, Their Country, and Their Future, and Why America Should Listen. Peter, you'll stay with us, right?
Absolutely.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is veteran journalist Peter Eichstadt. His latest book is called Above the Din of War, Afghans Speak About Their Lives, Their Country, and Their Future, and Why America Should Listen. Peter spent time in 2004 in Afghanistan working for the Nonprofit Institute for War and Peace Reporting, in that case helping to build Afghanistan's first independent news agency. He returned to Kabul in 2010 and worked there to interview an array of Afghans, also journalists. He's collected these experiences and conversations, discussion in his new book, Above the Din of War. Peter Eichstadt, let's talk a little bit more about some of these interviews you got from a vast array of Afghans there. In your book, we touch on the topic of self-immolation. Now, we connect that with the Vietnam War, This war is now longer than the Vietnam conflict was. We don't hear about that either. There are cases of self-immolation in Afghanistan?
Yes, it's been a phenomenon that is, it's not restricted to the West, but it's in the western city of Herat. It's actually Herat's the capital of Herat province, which borders on Iran. And when I was there in 2004, there were like 350 cases or more a year of women who were dousing themselves in kerosene, which is the most commonly and most common and readily available fuel there, which is used for both heating and cooking. And they would douse themselves on it and then light themselves a fire. And the problem was so pervasive that the international community helped the regional government there establish a special burn hospital to treat these victims.
So most often they would not die. They would be disfigured.
Well, actually, the doctors I spoke with said a majority of the victims do die. It takes a long time. Some of them are burned so badly, they have serious burns over 70-80% of their body, and they quite often die of infections. Quite often, that is just simply because the injuries are so severe that their bodies simply can't you know, cope with the damage. And but what these were, the vast majority of these victims were young women who had been sold into marriage to settle debts. Some of these fathers would literally just sell their daughters to another family, you know, for several thousand dollars. And you know, just a couple of days ago, there was a story. Actually, it was in the Sunday New York Times about a man who had done this. But it's a very, very common practice. And these poor young girls, many of the ones that I spoke to, had been sold to older men. And in fact, you know, marriage was kind of an excuse. What these young girls were actually did is they became house slaves for the families that they had been married into. And some of these girls were as young as 8 and 9 years old. I interviewed this one woman, young girl, who had set herself afire, and she claimed to be 15, but we spoke with her and spoke with the doctor and everything, and he assumed, he considered, and I had to agree with him, that she was probably no more than 12 years old, and she'd been married 3 years, and she'd been treated so badly, so she just decided to kill herself.
Self-immolation is a particularly public form of suicide. Horrible, of course. Why did they choose that method?
That was a question I ask a lot of people. And there's a women's shelter had been developed in Herat, and the woman that ran that shelter had been dealing with these problems for almost 10 years. Her sense of it, her explanation was that. Exactly what you said is that this is a very public protest, and it brings not only it highlights the miserable treatment that these young girls receive, but it also dishonors and embarrasses the families of these young girls. But it's their way of you know protesting against this terrible treatment that they've suffered. Unfortunately, it hasn't stopped the practice, but it's certainly put a damper on the practice. When I was there in 2011, there had been the number of cases had dropped to only a little less than 100 per year from the peak in 2004 of about right around 350. So this practice still continues, and ironically, it's it doesn't happen so much in other parts of the country, although it does happen sometimes, but it's largely concentrated in these western provinces.
In the bigger picture, we hear reports of how the status, the position of women in Afghan society has improved since the international forces have been there. Can you help us be a little bit hopeful that the intervention has at least helped a great majority or a great number of women in Afghanistan?
Well, it's happened. It's helped a lot of women, and the Afghan constitution requires that I think it was like 25%, 20-25% of the lower house of parliament is women. And there's a chapter in my book where I talk to a number of the female parliamentarians, and they're very courageous women. And they're not afraid to take on the fundamentalists and the Taliban. But the problem, and likewise, you're talking about younger women, there's been lots of schools have opened up, and lots of young women have been educated now. Under the Taliban, of course, young girls were not allowed to go to schools. But the problem is that most of this progress has been made in urban areas, and only about 25% of all Afghans live in urban areas. 75% live in the rural areas, and these rural areas are quite often without electricity, and these rural areas are also where government control is negligible, and this is where the Taliban has the most strength. And so it's much more difficult for a young girl in a rural area, which is, like I said, 75% of the country, to get an education than it is in an urban area.
These women who have come to the fore to be young leaders, parliamentarians that you spoke with in Afghanistan, they must be filled with trepidation at the thought of the Taliban coming back into power.
Yeah, absolutely. And I that's why one of my arguments is that, we can't just pull out lock, stock, and barrel like we did in Iraq, because the Taliban is poised right now to fill whatever power void or vacuum that we leave there. And this is a terrible situation for women, and it's a terrible situation for anybody who's worked with Western organizations.
And on the other hand, what can we do there that we haven't done in the past 12 years?
The crux of the problem, I think, is that we have focused almost exclusively on conducting a war there, and we have not done what we should have done in terms of actually building civil society and improving the economy so that average Afghans feel like their lives, they have a future, and they feel like their lives are better. We focus all of our resources on fighting the Taliban and building up the Afghan military forces. And what's happened in the background is that, the trust and of the average Afghan in their government and in Karzai's corrupt government has just dwindled to nothing. So that, now most Afghans dislike the presence of the international community since their lives have not improved.
Well, it sure seems, though, if I can interrupt here, Peter, it sure seems like we've not only had the military side, but the civilian side. I've interviewed plenty of people on this program, Iowans, in fact, who have been to Afghanistan working for NGOs in an effort to build up communities, infrastructure, and so on. So,
What happens, the question is, what happens when we pull out, and what happens when that aid is no longer available, and what happens when the training stops? That's the question. We've created this. We've done a lot of good. We've helped a lot of people, of course, but the Afghan economy is pretty much 90% dependent on foreign aid. And unless we have a constant and steady stream of aid and training, et cetera, to help develop the economy, as we withdraw our support, there's going to be nothing left. The Afghans don't have a self-sustaining economy at this point.
Peter Eichstadt is my guest, veteran journalist, if you've just joined us. His new book is titled Above the Din of War, Afghans Speak About Their Lives, Their Country, and Their Future, and Why America Should Listen. He's coming to Iowa next Tuesday, April 9th, to speak before the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council at noon. You also interviewed for this book would-be suicide bombers in Afghanistan. Tell us about them.
Well, there was a number of couple of cases that I got very interested in, and the first one was what got me into the suicide bomber story was that not far from where I lived, a mullah was arrested, and he was arrested with about 25 bombs buried in his the floor of his little house next to a mosque where he worked, or where he was the mullah. And as you know, a mullah is like a community or like a neighborhood priest or minister. And so I got to talking with the security forces who had arrested him about how they had arrested, the arrest had come about. This mullah was part of a network of an underground network in which these young boys would be taken off the streets in various places around Afghanistan. Some of them were taken to Pakistan under the premise that they were going to get an education at one of the religious schools in Pakistan. In fact, what was happening is that these young boys were being recruited to be turned into suicide bombers. And they were taken from their homes at a very young age, you know, anywhere between 8 and 10. And then they would be trained, quote unquote, in a religious school to be indoctrinated so that they would be more than happy to strap on a suicide bomber's vest and, you know, walk close to international forces or step into a street or walk into a government building and blow themselves up and kill a bunch of people. And the Afghan, as I pursued the story, the Afghan forces had grabbed a couple of boys or a number of boys that were coming across the border from Pakistan for this specific purpose, and it put them in a juvenile prison. And so that's where I talked to them, and they described their experiences and how this network had been established that, you know, they were, had been, like I said, taken off the streets and, you know, put into the system, and they were on their way to Kabul to meet rendezvous with an uncle. They said it was going to give them a good job, and they had telephone numbers and things like that we tried to call.
Were they at the point where they were, had they reached the point where they were willing to become a suicide bomber?
No, these young boys were at the very front end of this thing. And
I see.
They really had very little idea what was happening to them. And the security forces that I was working with were the ones that were filling in the blanks here. And these boys, though, fortunately, were pulled out of the system before they were trapped. And they were eventually sent overseas to safe houses, and they were given an education. One of the young suicide bombers that I interviewed, though, was from a community in the south central Afghanistan, and he had been grabbed by the Taliban and told to do some small tasks for them, like such as spying on the local police station, and then he had to report back to them police activity. And he, at one point, was the police got suspicious because this young boy was hanging around the police station. So they arrested him and kept him in jail for a couple days, and then released him to his father. And then the Taliban then got suspicious that he was working for the police.
Sure.
And then turned around and told him that if he didn't conduct an attack and on the local, there's a U.S. military outpost nearby. If he didn't put on a suicide vest and go attack this outpost, that he would be killed. Not only he would be killed, but that his family would be killed.
Wow.
And so he did that, and he agreed to do it because he felt like this was his only way out. So when he went through the training, he put on the vest, and then the Taliban put him on the back of a motorcycle, took him close, dropped him off, and then turned around and drove away. Well, the young boy went to a tree nearby, stripped off his suicide vest, dropped his gun, and then turned himself into the outpost. So he ended up actually helping U.S. Special Forces go after a group of Taliban in the nearby town.
And as far as we know, the boy is safe, but his family as well?
Yeah, and so anyway, the boy was eventually turned over to Afghan authorities, and that's where I encountered him. But he was kind of a lost soul because he couldn't go home because he had never carried out this mission. If he showed up back at his village, he'd be killed. He was afraid for his father and the rest of his family, but he knew he would never be able to see them again because he could never go home.
You also talked with archaeologists. Of course, a lot of archaeological finds in Afghanistan. We remember early on in the taking power of the Taliban, they destroyed those huge statues, which have existed for centuries.
The Buddha statues.
Yeah. Archaeologists at work in this war scene?
Well, what's interesting is I went back to Bamiyan, and there's still a lot of archaeological work there because
this is where those huge statues were.
Yeah, and there was this long. I mean, for more than 500 years, Bamiyan was the center of a large Buddhist retreat and monastery, and that's why these Buddhist statues were carved there. And of course, by the it was a, they were eventually pushed out by the by Islam, but the focus of a lot of the archaeological work that's going on now is actually taking place not too far from Kabul. It's like southeast of Kabul, and the reason it's taking place is that the Chinese have secured a 25-year lease for what looks to be one of the largest copper mines or copper deposits in the world. And but unfortunately, sitting on top of this potential copper mine is another ancient Buddhist, archaeological site. So the international community has helped bring in a team of about 20, 25 archaeologists from around the world who are working with Afghan archaeologists to excavate this site before the mining begins.
Mm-hmm. Are archaeologists in any danger? I mean, does the Taliban take an interest in this, want to prevent this?
Well, that's a good question because what I was told is that the Taliban had, in fact, plundered a lot of the most valuable artifacts that were at this site. And the United States and the international community really didn't get going on the archaeological work until about 2 years ago. And at that point, a lot of the place had been plundered. And so what's happened is that there's a tremendous deployment of Afghan national police to secure the site, and it had to be demined. It was still in the process of being demined when I was there. And then the Afghan Office of Archaeology was heading up the excavation, but they had hired a lot of people from the local community who I was told had been at one point part of the Taliban. So they were kind of, as you say, being bought off because they were being hired to work and actually do the manual labor at the excavation site.
Peter Eichstadt, I want to thank you for joining us this hour, but before we say goodbye, I wonder, thank you for all the insights, the firsthand experiences that you are communicating in your new book, Above the Din of War, and are talking about us this hour. Not anything we find terribly uplifting, especially after this length.
Unfortunately, I wish I could be more optimistic.
Are there any signs of hope you can leave us with?
Well, I would hope a number of things. One is that I hope the United States and the international community maintain some kind of sustained long-term presence there, because I think without it, Afghanistan is simply going to, devolve and revert to civil war. And I think a good, a long-term peace process is necessarily going to have to involve the Taliban. And as I suggest in my book,
talks seem to be going on at this time too, right?
Yes, yeah, but the problem, what I'm concerned about though is that these talks have gone on in the past and have really gone nowhere. And I think, like my friend in the the president of the Afghan Senate said, we really have to involve Pakistan in any kind of long-term deal, because Pakistan and also Iran have the power to keep things so unsettled in Afghanistan that without their support, I don't think there's a much chance for a long-term peace in Afghanistan.
Peter Eichstadt, thank you very much for joining us this hour. Above the Din of War is Peter's latest book. Afghans speak about their lives, their country, and their future, and why America should listen. Peter, always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.